Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week, we've got an interview about the last book by New York Times correspondent Anthony Shadid, who died recently in Syria. How architects of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial in Washington, D.C. planned to fix a mistake literally set in stone. And the British singer Estelle, on leaving London and finding her way to success in the United States with her new album, All of Me. But first.
Uruguay boasts that it has the longest carnival celebration, not just in Latin America, but in the world. It goes on for 40 days. Makeshift stages pop up all around the capital city of Montevideo for performances of a choral music called murga. Murga is both a form of entertainment and a socio-political commentary that survived the military dictatorship of the 1970s. Martina Castro reports from Montevideo.
Listen, the song says. This song tells the story of the oldest murga choir in Uruguay. It's called Los Curtidores de Hongos. That guttural, forceful tone of singing has been with murga from the beginning. Eduardo Ravelino, director of the Museum of Carnival in Montevideo, says murga was working class. Street salesmen would sing in the same tone that they'd shout out on the streets. Some were born of labor unions, Ravelino says. Six or seven street musicians who'd get together to have a good time and sing about what was happening in society. The tradition came to Uruguay via Cádiz, Spain, more than 100 years ago, where they have a similar choral music called chirigota. Today, a murga choir is made up of 13 voices singing complex harmonies, accompanied by three percussionists plus a choral director. They wear elaborate, circus-like costumes and makeup and compete every carnival. Now some choirs even have sponsors and CDs, but they still parody the talk of the town that year, be it corrupt politicians, a spike in violence, or that annoying recording you get when you call for a taxi. Daniel Ángel Carlucho is the director of Los Curtidores de Hongos. He says the riskiest time for murga was during Uruguay's military dictatorship of the 70s and early 80s. Carlucho had just joined a group then. He says when choirs wanted to criticize the government, they had to use metaphors to avoid being censored. Murga choirs formed a bond with the public during that time. Today you can see that bond at the tablados, makeshift stages that are set up all over Montevideo. Like this one at the Defensor Sporting Club. This is Agarrate Catalina, one of the younger murga choirs and last year's competition winner. The name is a popular saying here that basically means, watch out, because something's about to happen. In just one song, they'll go from making fun of hippie culture to criticizing their former president. Murga attacks everything, says Jamandu Cardoso. He's the director of Agarrate Catalina. Dozens of young murga choirs have formed since the 90s. Groups enunciate better now. There are female singers and different instruments. But Cardoso says it's important to preserve certain elements of how murga has always been. Of the people who sing murga, Cardoso says, the majority of them make a living doing something else. They work in a factory or an office. They're artists for a month and a half and then go back to their daily lives. So, he says, that's why murga doesn't represent the masses. They are the masses. Cardoso says when it's time for the music to begin, it's just 13 guys singing their hearts out in front of their people.
Encarnada.
The death in Syria 2 weeks ago of correspondent Anthony Shadid was a devastating loss for journalism and the Middle East. He did so much to illuminate. The Middle East was a place he found himself drawn back to 3 generations after his family left Lebanon for life in Oklahoma City. Anthony Shadid had just written a memoir tracing the year he spent reconstructing the abandoned home of his great-grandfather. It's titled House of Stone. And to speak about the book, we turn to those close to him. Rajiv Chandrasekharan shared the Washington Post Baghdad house with Anthony just after the invasion of Iraq.
You know, he could tell the difference between Arabic spoken by somebody from Najaf versus somebody from Anbar province. And it allowed him a degree of intimacy in his conversations. You know, the Iraqis would often give their children names intended to ward off the evil eye. So one common name that he remarked upon was the Arabic word mudlum, which literally means to be oppressed. And so every day from then on, it was this sort of running joke. Which one of us, given our sort of respective obligations to file stories or dodge bullets, it was a race to see who could claim the title of mudlum first. But he'd see these little details in ways that, quite frankly, the rest of us, even with the benefit of translators, it was sort of like taking a picture and photocopying it. You'd lose all the detail and nuance.
I find his writing stunning, and rereading it is no less so. You know, he's looking down in one article at the body of a 14-year-old who's just been killed, and writes, "With a cotton swab dipped in water, he ran his hand across Daif's olive corpse. Dead for 3 hours, but still glowing with life. He blotted the rose-red shrapnel wounds on the soft skin of his right arm." And his father, later in the article, describes his own son as like a flower. The son became, in Anthony Shadid's writing, an olive tree, a rose.
And there's a broader metaphor here that in Marjayoun, the town where he rebuilt his ancestral home, it once used to be the land of wonderful olive trees. It seems as if he is also sort of conjuring up the lost beauty of the landscape.
Well, tell us about that. When Anthony announced he was taking a year-long leave from the Washington Post, and he's going to go back to this abandoned house of his great-grandfather and fix it up.
You know, he was Anthony, and I had no idea the sweep of history, you know, that would come together in this memoir. I shouldn't have doubted that he would build a house, but he'd build an even grander book.
And there is this moment in the book where Anthony Shadid writes, "That day and for more that followed, I gleefully, frenetically lost myself in the tile, as I once had with stories in Beirut, Baghdad, and Cairo." Does that seem right to you? He's obsessing with these beautiful tiles, actually, but they're the floor tiles, but he's lost in them.
When I read that, to me, you know, it's a mosaic of the new world he's building in much the same way that those stories of people, you know, form the mosaic of his professional body of work.
And, well, he made stories out of those tiles, too. He gave them names. I mean, I'm looking, he goes, "The most beautiful arabesque wheels of a dozen spokes in reds, yeah, greens, blues, and cream. An 8-pointed star cast in red and blue."
And he's, you know, the tile was his mark on the edifice.
The memoir, House of Stone, is dedicated to Anthony Shadid's family, his young children, Layla and Malik, and his wife, Nada Bakri. She met him just after he fell under the spell of the house.
Sadly, the house was falling apart in a very, very bad shape. And he saw the 2 olive trees and completely fell in love with them. And in Lebanon, the way they pick olives, they just get a big stick and just beat the tree until all the olives fall. But Anthony would pick them 1 olive by 1. And he would have a pile of the perfect olives, a pile of the less perfect olives. It was an art. And he would be so happy doing it.
It also seemed symbolic of how he saw the world that he was in at that time, a world of strife and war. He describes in the book that the harvest there is aggressive. The tree is pillaged, the vine stripped. And
he
wanted to do it so differently.
He loved these trees. He was treating them like a human being, and he just could not bear the thought of being aggressive with them.
The people of Marjayoun, though, when he first came back, they often weren't all that hospitable to him. I mean, they didn't quite know what to make of Anthony Shadid, you know, great-grandson of the man who left, coming back, rebuild this house. Why was that?
You know, it's just Marjayoun right now, it's full of these beautiful old houses that are completely abandoned. Anthony would often call them, as they do in Lebanon, Hajar Bala Bashar, or stone without people. And so seeing someone who actually came back and wanted to rebuild was first met with a lot of skepticism. But then I think later, a lot of people were very proud of what he did, and they would often come up to him and Dom, you know, we wish others would do the same.
Would you read for us how Anthony saw the future in this house? It's the very last thing he wrote. And it employs a word that we haven't exactly talked about. It employs a word that's spelled B-A-Y-T.
Bait. It's home. But also in Arabic, it means house, it means family, it means all of the above. To Anthony, finding this place or this home or this bait was everything, where he imagined his kids to be one day, where he found peace. I'm going to read from the book. As I had so often, I walked beside Isber's house of stone, passing the two most ancient olive trees. I thought of my daughter, soon to arrive, walking up the steps from which her great-grandmother had departed. In my mind's eye, I saw Layla, suddenly grown, beside the trees and repeating the Arabic words that I would one day teach her, words that would take her back to Isber's world, where the Litani River runs, over Marjayoun, over what was once our land. This is Beit. This is what we imagined. So this was the place that he imagined as his home, and it was his home.
Is he home now? Is he buried there?
You know, he would often joke. We'd be sitting in the garden, and he would tell me that when he dies, he would want me to cremate his body and just spread his ashes in the garden. I guess I was unlucky enough that I did that. So yes, he's. I put him between the two olive trees that he loved so much, and I put tiles on top of the spot where I put him. So I think he's happy there.
Everyone's heart goes out to you.
Thank you.
Nada Bakri speaking about House of Stone, a memoir of home, family, and a lost Middle East by her late husband, Anthony Shadid. This is NPR News.
Fix it. That order from Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. He was talking about the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial on the National Mall. The fix is to a quote on the statue of Dr. King that has been taken out of context. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports on how the Park Service will now try to change something that is literally set in stone.
First, some background and a little more context about that quote. It was taken from a sermon Dr. King gave in 1968 at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, in which he talked about the drum major instinct.
And that is deep down within all of us, an instinct. It's a kind of drum major instinct, a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first.
In the 40-minute sermon, he talks about what happens when this very human instinct is not harnessed, how it leads people to seek material gain or become racist, even start wars. But then he says there are drum majors who use their drive in service to humanity. Dr. King says even Jesus believed that instinct was important in order to lead.
And he said, yes, don't give up this instinct. It's a good instinct if you use it right.
Towards the end of the sermon, given just 2 months before his assassination, Dr. King talked about how he'd like to be remembered. And this is the full quote that was originally intended for the statue of Dr. King at the memorial.
Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all of the other shallow things will not matter.
But in the construction process, the decision was made to paraphrase the statement. So now it says simply, I was a drum major for justice, peace, and righteousness.
I believe that we caught the essence of his statement.
Ed Jackson is the chief architect of the MLK Jr. Memorial. He says the sculptor and the engraver felt strongly that fewer words should be used on the statue of Dr. King because of space limitations. It's also not the only quote. When you visit the memorial, you walk along a long wall that has several other, much longer quotes from Dr. King. Then you arrive at the statue, which is called the Stone of Hope. Ed Jackson says that's another reason they decided less was more.
Because by the time the visitor engages the Stone of Hope, the profile of Dr. King, they're beyond the point where they're interested in reading a lot of detail. And so the essence there is to capture the essence of a statement, but allow them to focus more on the art piece itself.
Last August, the Washington Post reported that truncating the quote changed its meaning, making Dr. King sound boastful. Maya Angelou went further, saying the quote made him sound like an arrogant twit. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar recently instructed the National Park Service, which will maintain the memorial, to fix it.
The abbreviated quote lost the significance of that statement, and it's something which Dr. King's family all agreed that they didn't like the quote as it had been abbreviated. And the other members of the civil rights community and many others that we consulted with were all in agreement that the quote had to be changed. So, we're going to do it.
Just how they're going to do it hasn't yet been decided. Nick Benson, who engraved the quotes on the King Memorial, declined to be interviewed. Benson is a third-generation stone letter carver and a MacArthur Fellow. His work can be seen at the FDR and World War II memorials. It took Benson and a team of five assistants about 3 months to chisel the quotes on the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial.
The letters that Nick does are like a faceted type groove in the stone, and the light hits that very boldly, and it's powerful.
Andy Yule is a stone carver at the National Cathedral. He says there are likely two options when it comes to fixing the quote.
I think their options are one to reduce the surface back and recarve, or maybe take out the whole section and install a panel with matching material and then carve that installed panel.
But Yule says matching the stone will be difficult, even if the replacement comes from the same quarry.
Once something is designed to look a certain way, changing it is always a compromise.
I don't understand what they want to change then. Why would you want to change something?
Yolanda Connor from Dallas is like a handful of visitors to the MLK Jr. Memorial that I talked to recently. She says she's just fine with the drum major quote the way it is.
A drum major is a leader. He represented peace. Why wouldn't you want him? Why wouldn't you want to follow someone that represents peace?
Janine Gordine from Camden, New Jersey, believes the quote was taken out of context, but she does not think it needs to be fixed.
I don't know. Sometimes we make controversy when there doesn't have to be controversy, and I just don't think that it's that important. It shouldn't take away from this beautiful monument. It shouldn't take away from all that he did and all that he said and all that he was to America. To America.
So leave it as it is?
Leave it as it is.
Gordine says if people really want the full context of the quote, they'll need to go home and read the whole sermon. It won't fit on a stone. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
In the early days of the environmental movement, the children's author Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, wrote a book about saving trees. That 1971 book has now been made into a film, opening today, Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. Kenneth Turan has our review.
Movies have always monkeyed around with their source material, but Dr. Seuss's The Lorax actually apologizes for what it's about to do. The fuzzy orange Lorax, amiably voiced by Danny DeVito, steps out in front of a theater curtain and announces, "There's more to this story than what's on the page. You have been warned." Let's start with 12-year-old Ted, voiced by Zac Efron.
So, Mom, do you happen to know if there's, like, any place where I could get a real tree?
He's a miniature adult who uses breath freshener spray and has the wiseacre attitude of a Las Vegas lounge lizard. This irritating young man is infatuated with a girl named Audrey.
Hey, she's not some girl. She's a woman in high school, and she loves trees.
Fortunately, real trees have disappeared from the town. The only person who seems to have a clue about them is Ted's grandmother, voiced by Betty White.
Okay, here's the deal. The Onceler is the man who knows what happened to the trees. You want one? You need to find him.
Once the Onceler is tracked down to a desolate area, he is rightly suspicious of Ted's motives.
Why aren't you like other kids, breakdancing and playing the Donkey Kongs?
The Onceler eventually describes how his own youthful greed put him into conflict with the Lorax, who, as every reader of the Dr. Seuss original knows, speaks loud and clear for the trees. But to expand Seuss's slim volume to theatrical feature length, a whole lot of plot and heaping handfuls of characters needed to be invented. These new individuals are for the most part unpleasant, and the new aspects of a story are forced. By the time a cheerful song tries to rescue the film at the end, the original Lorax has left the building and is not coming back.
Kenneth Duran reviews movies for Morning Edition and the LA Times.
Estelle!
Yeah?
Breezy. Sugar. Can I say
some? Estelle Soiree is a Londoner, but for the past few years, she's called the USA home. Huh. Wonder if American boys have anything to do with that. Walk in that wall, talk that slick talk. Liking this American boy, American boy. Take me on a trip, I'd like to go someday. That's American Boy, Estelle Soiree's 2008 Grammy-winning hit with Kanye West. Songs featured on her album Shine, and since then, boy, has she, with her silky vocals, smooth raps, and punchy lyrics. Estelle Soiree's latest album is called All of Me, and she joined us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So, you're over here for the guys?
Yeah. I wish I could say yes. No, I was signed my record deal in 2007, and I moved over here to work on the album and put out Shine, and I've been here ever since.
Can we talk a bit about your background?
Mm-hmm.
Born in London, as mm-hmm. we noted. Your mother is from Senegal.
Yeah.
Your father from Grenada. Do we hear much of that in your music?
Absolutely. My dad, being from the West Indies, and my mom, they love reggae music and African music, and it all squishes together in my approach.
Mm-hmm.
I think with music and the instruments I use, I'm a big fan of bass lines and drums. You know, so like a lot of my music is bass heavy or drum heavy. Yeah. I'm less of the acoustic artist and more of the feeling, the grip type of artist.
Was there a point when you were young, Estelle, that you heard a song, you heard a singer, and said to yourself,
this is it? Yeah, when I was 3, I remember seeing Bob Marley on TV, and I just remember this guy being on stage shaking his head and losing it and being in the spirit. And I remember just staring at this guy like, what's he doing, you know? And that's kind of like my first musical memory, my first version of this is what I want to do, I think. And I ran away from it for a while, and it kind of came back to me.
Let's listen to a song from this new album. This is a song called Wonderful Life. What makes my day slow down, watching the rain, and now I'm not on time. I'm about to lay down and cry, boss on the other line. Had a fight with my back, is he? Swears I'm lying. A lot of these songs are about heartbreak.
And how to get over it. I write about my life, and my life is by no means as nice and as happy as American Boy seems. It's been a lot of ups, a lot of downs, a lot of hurts, a lot of pain, a lot of happy times. And the thing that kind of holds me together is I always find a way over it. So when I write from that perspective of like, it might not be good today, but it's going to be better tomorrow. That's what Wonderful Life was about. Just keep smiling, it'll be all right.
not ask. Madonna, Gwen Stefani. Yeah. They're Americans who've gone to London.
Yeah.
So why have you gone to the other?
Yeah. Well, because I kind of hit a glass ceiling at home. No one quite got where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. So I'd been friends with John Legend and Kanye West for a while, and I'd worked with John Legend on my first record, and he was like, look, come to America, I got you. Just, I'll sign you. I was like, are you sure? Because you're not my handful. You know, I have things to say, and you're not going to be able to put me in a cookie cutter. It's not going to work. He's like, I know. I'm clear about this. Yeah. Come on. So he did, and he stuck with it, and here we go.
Let's listen to another song if we can from your new CD. This one is Speak Your Mind.
I'm nice in my skin, I love every color. I got the body God gave me, don't want another. Well, well, I'm woman, it don't matter the shade. And what you really, really want is a lady that's paid. Paid on her terms, not this titsy ditsy. Take these look good girls and miss me. Cause half of y'all would have lost a minute in my circle. Shade, shade, shade in a minute, watch them curdle. And this is not an attack at them. I just want them to do better than they're doing with their men. I just want them to aim high, stop their gripping and their grin. I just want them to pull out the miseducation again. It's crucial times and we're here debasing. I gotta tell the truth, y'all face it. All you have to do is speak your mind.
Well, I think it speaks for itself, but tell us what you're trying to put across here.
So as I'm traveling, as I'm going around, it just started getting me angry, the amount of just the general lack of wanting to do for themselves that the younger generation of women are having. I was raised on like Queen Latifah. I was raised on Lauryn Hill, Nina Simone. I was raised on Mary J. Blige. I was raised on strong or women that had a point of view that made you feel empowered. And as I'm traveling in the States and the world, it's like a strain of women that were coming up that are like, I guess, I'll just roll with it, football-wise, basketball-wise, all these different wives on TV. And you're like, are you just content being someone's wife? And it frustrates me because I'm not that way. I can't co-sign that message. It's entertaining, but it's not real life. And these young girls don't know the difference between speaking your mind and putting more value in being educated and being about something than what you look like and what shoes you have today. That's where this comes from.
Did it ever occur to you that there's a somewhere in this world, in the United States, in the UK, there's a three-year-old kid who's listening to you, maybe seeing one of your videos?
If that is true and if that is real, I don't even know what to say or do about that. I just hope that I'm doing the right thing. I couldn't be happy with my existence knowing that, you know, I sang this and this child, and it was dishonest, it was from a mean place, and this kid saw me do that and it influenced their entire life. No way. You know, so I hope I'm doing the right thing.
Hey! Estelle, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Estelle, in our studio, her new album, All of Me, is out now. And you can hear more music from Estelle by going to our website, nprmusic.org.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff, and it's executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.